And 24 steps a minute would be the metronome of 96 total beats per minute on your metronome. So this is then measures the client's pulse, or then what you're going to do is you're going to measure the client's pulse for 60 seconds and record the number as the recovery pulse. And what you'll find is that in your chapter 6 text, you will find that reference sheet in the sense of what recovery pulse will give you what sort of cardiorespiratory level, which is like poor or average or good or excellent, more or less. So moving over to slide 35, the step test, yeah, there it is. We have the poor, fair, average, good, and very good. And if you end up with poor to fair, you're gonna want to start that client in a zone 1 cardiorespiratory training program. If they end up with like average or good, then you can move them into a zone 2 training program. And it, only if they're extremely good, which isn't as common with a brand new client, then you can move them into zone 3 or just do all different types of training without any need or caution, you could say. So moving on to slide 36. The Rockport walk test is the next cardiorespiratory assessment, and the Rockport walk test is going to be a little bit more accurate in the sense of more of a cardiorespiratory assessment that's longer term. So with the Rockport walk test, you're going to have them walk a mile as fast as they can, and that typically takes about 15, maybe 14 minutes at the fastest. Maybe even 13:50 or something is the fastest one that I've seen walked. And depending on that, you're going to start them in zone 1, zone 2, or zone 3. So let's go ahead and click over to slide 37 and talk more about this. You're going to have the client, you're going to record the client's weight and age, and you're going to have them walk 1 mile as fast as he or she can control on a treadmill. Record the time it takes the client to complete that walk, and immediately record the client's heart rate in beats per minute. All right, and that's at the 1 mile mark. So you're going to measure their radial pulse at the 1 mile mark, or if they're on a treadmill with a heart rate monitor, you can then use that heart rate monitor to determine where their heart rate is at. And what this will do is it will help you to calculate the VO2 score. And VO2 score is relevant. You can find out different athletes' VO2 scores by looking online. For instance, Kobe Bryant's was like 62.5, which is very high. Lance Armstrong's was somewhere around 80 when he was in peak shape. And I think the highest one ever recorded was 93. But typically you're going to find people are around the 40s, maybe high 30s, maybe even low 50s if they're in good shape and currently do a lot of cardiorespiratory exercise. So clicking over to slide 38, what happens according to the chart when they get a poor score or fair, they're going to end up in zone 1, meaning that you should pretty much limit them to zone 1 for the time being. If they get an average or good score, you can move in zone 1 and zone 2. And then if they get a very good, then you really have no caution as far as putting them in any type of cardiorespiratory training program. And moving on to slide 39, posture and movement is going to be our next major topic. And everyone, or basically posture and movement is going to be the base of support, which you generate force or accept force. And this is going to be known as posture. And posture specifically is the alignment and function of all components of the human movement system at any given moment. So most people, when they think of posture, it's like, oh, hey, you sit up straight at the dinner table, that sort of thing. Or just, try to sit back and keep your shoulders back and don't let your head drift too far forward. There's a lot more to posture that we're going to learn through these fitness assessments, and specifically like the overhead squat assessment, static assessment, pushing and pulling assessment. But what this is going to do is work. It's going to allow us to determine whether our clients are functional movers. Can they move efficiently without predisposing themselves to pain? So moving on to slide 40, posture, to define it a little bit more clearly, proper posture ensures that the muscles of the body are optimally aligned at the proper length-tension relationships, which we did talk about previously, and necessary for efficient functioning of force couples and joint motion. So basically, proper posture ensures that the muscles are not overactive or shortened, so that they can all work together to produce the proper movement without creating any pain or putting the body at risk for injury. And they talk a little bit about neuromuscular efficiency, which is the ability of the nervous system to execute all the muscles or all the movements, or properly recruit all muscles in all planes of motion efficiently. So moving over to slide 41, They say without proper posture alignment, we set the body up for a series of traumas known as postural distortion patterns. And if you have postural distortion patterns, it's going to put you at risk or higher risk for injury. And specifically, I see a lot of these postural distortion patterns in runners, in which if you land with your foot strike being your foot being externally rotated, you're going to be moving your entire kinetic chain out of alignment and potentially putting more pressure on one side of the knee or one side of the hip or one side of the low back, and it's going to create pain all the way up the entire human movement system. But what postural distortion patterns are more or less predictable patterns of muscle imbalance. So let's click over to slide 42. What is a muscle imbalance? So muscle imbalance, you can kind of think of as a lever. As the picture shows right here, if one side of the muscle is going to be shortened, the other side of the lever is going to be lengthened. And that's basically what they're showing you in that picture on the muscle imbalance slide 42. And they're going to describe it as a condition in which the lengths of muscles are altered at the joint. So this leads to poor posture. For instance, if your pectoralis major or your chest muscle is pulling your shoulders forward, you're going to have sort of a rounded shoulder posture. And it's going to be important to, you're going to want to lengthen the chest muscle so that it can sit further back, and you're going to want to strengthen the middle back or the trapezius muscles or rhomboids in order to pull your shoulders back and allow for the proper posture to be had. And poor posture, repetitive movement, and lack of daily movement are considered contributing factors to muscle imbalances. So moving over to slide 43, more about postural distortions. We have predictable patterns of muscle imbalance, which are lower crossed, upper crossed, and pronation distortion syndrome. And these are going to be very common movement impairment patterns or patterns of muscle imbalances. And the one that I've been seeing a lot and typically with most of my clients is going to be the pronation distortion syndrome. And this is one of the most dangerous as it puts the knee and hips and low back in a position to create a ton of pain. And we're talking like ACL injuries, IT band syndrome, meaning like your IT band gets inflamed and your lateral knee hurts, just a lot of bad stuff. But let's talk about all of them as you might see all of these in the field. So pronation distortion syndrome is going to be flattened feet and internally rotated knees, or the knees when they squat are going to adduct. And this is basically, yeah, once again, it's characterized by flattened feet or internally or adducted knees. When we talked about joint motions earlier in previous chapters, adduction of knees is basically the knees coming together towards the midline of the body. And we remember, we want the knees to stay directly straight over the feet during your squat. But as you can see in the picture, the pronation distortion syndrome is where the feet cave in and the knees cave in, causing a lot of potential lateral pain of the knee, lateral wearing of the meniscus or cartilage in the knee. And it's characterized by a tight gastrocnemius or lateral gastrocnemius, which is the side of your big calf muscle, the soleus, the peroneals, the adductors, the IT band, hip flexors, and biceps femoris. And what's weak is going to be the anterior and posterior tibialis, vastus medialis, gluteus maximus, and medius, and hip external rotators. So a lot of these muscles might sound like jibber jabber as I say them, but it's going to be really important to understand within all assessments and all movement distortion patterns is what is tight and what is weak. Because the muscles that are tight need to be foam rolled and stretched, and the muscles that are weak need to be strengthened or activated, you could say. And a lot of muscles are commonly tight, and that's one thing that I really point out when I teach this is that you're looking for a pattern of muscles that are always tight. For instance, the lateral gastrocnemius is always tight during all movement impairment or all muscle imbalances. The soleus is always tight in muscle imbalances. Peroneals is the same. And hip flexors and biceps femoris are always, always tight. And weak muscles, well, the anterior and posterior tibialis, they're always weak muscles, which are located on the front of your shins, and commonly where you get shin splints, you could say. The vastus medialis, which is the middle quadricep or the medial quadricep. Gluteus maximus and medius are always weak. They're never tight. They're always lengthened and not that strong in muscle imbalances. And then your hip external rotators are also going to be potentially weak. And specifically with this pronation distortion syndrome, there's going to be a test question in which they ask, which of the following muscles is overactive? And I starred the lateral gastroc because this is the most common answer as to what is going to be tight during pronation distortion syndrome. So clicking over to slide 45, we have lower crossed syndrome, and this is going to be characterized by an anterior pelvic tilt, where as you can see in the picture, you have the guy's hips are kind of arched and his low back has a little extra arch. His hips are tilted forward and he has a little bit of a low back arch. So what muscles are tight and what muscles are weak is going to be important to know. And the gastroc, soleus, hip flexors, adductors, latissimus dorsi, or lats, and the erector spinae are the ones that are commonly tight. So the ones that are commonly weak are the gluteus maximus, gluteus medius, anterior tibialis, posterior tibialis, transverse abdominis, which is your deepest core muscle, and internal obliques. And if you notice from the slide before, the gastroc, soleus, hip flexors are also tight in the other one. And what's also weak in pronation distortion is gluteus maximus and medius, gluteus medius, anterior tibialis, posterior tibialis. So these are very commonly tight and weak muscles. So it's important to kind of recognize which muscles are kind of tight and kind of weak. You better recognize. All right, 46, slide 46, upper cross syndrome, rounded shoulders and forward head. This is what I was talking about earlier with the computer work. If you do a lot of computer work, you're staring at the computer exactly like you're doing it now. Oh, sit up straight again. And you are going to potentially increase your risk for tight front of the body and weak back of the body. And specifically, the tight muscles are going to be like the lats, like I mentioned before, the pec major and minor, and a lot of other muscles in there that I would want you to know. And weak muscles, serratus anterior, rhomboids, that notice there's a star by the rhomboids, that as that's a typical test question, which of the following muscles might be weak in upper crossed syndrome? The rhomboids, remember the rhomboids are going to be in between your shoulder blades, and when you squeeze your shoulder blades together, you're activating your rhomboids, and that is good posture. And weak muscles are typically preventing you from holding yourself in that upright position in the upper cross syndrome. So, also you might see deep cervical flexors. Your deep cervical flexors are the ones that kind of pull your neck back into alignment in between your shoulder blades, and those are always weak as well. And and also the infraspinatus. When we get into this further, we're going to look at the rotator cuff, and the infraspinatus is going to be a specific external rotator, which I will feel comfortable if you guys do know that, as it is going to be important for the field to understand the rotator cuff. So moving forward to slide 47. So movement observations, the way that we determine whether someone has pronation distortion, lower cross syndrome, or upper cross syndrome is by looking at their movement patterns or even their static posture. So we're looking at dynamic postural observations are often the quickest way to gain an overall impression of the client's functional status, and they should relate to basic functions such as squatting, pushing, pulling, and maybe on one leg balancing. And this can also be incorporated into the first workout for your client. For instance, doing the overhead squat, which you'll see in a few slides, is an actual exercise that you can determine someone's posture on. So moving over to slide 48, the overhead squat assessment is going to be your go-to for movement observations. You can tell a ton about someone by looking at their squat, and specifically their overhead squat. And to directly read what it says, the overhead squat assessment is designed to assess dynamic flexibility on both sides of the body as well as integrated total body strength. This assessment is possible for most clients and even for pregnant females. And I started that as there is a test question that asks which of the following assessments is going to be okay to do with a pregnant client. And the overhead squat is totally fine. It's absolutely completely fine no matter how far into the pregnancy. Obviously, if you get more towards that 8 to 9 months, the belly could come into contact with the knees, in which, you know, at that point, it's not like they're going to be doing too crazy of exercises anyways. So the position, what do you want? You want to direct them to have their feet shoulder width apart and pointed straight ahead, and the foot and ankle complex should be in a neutral position, meaning it shouldn't be externally rotated, and also have them raise their arms overhead with their elbow fully extended and trying to keep their arm in between or bisecting their ears or right at the ear level. So moving over to slide 49, this is going to be the picture on the right is the lower portion of the overhead squat and what it should look like. And specifically, you want to tell them to do about 5 squats, and you're going to look at them from the lateral portion or lateral view, which is the one shown here on slide 49, and also from the anterior view or from the front. And you're going to want them to, yeah, once again, repeat that about 5 times. And every time with me, what I have them do is I say, can you, or try to go a little bit lower, try to go a little bit lower, try to get a little bit lower. If someone can do a perfect overhead squat, that means they get their butt almost to their heels and they stay in a nice straight and upright position. Typically, almost none of my clients I've ever had have been able to do that. So it's important to understand that you're going to have to work with almost all clients in correcting their muscle imbalances. Which some clients will want you to do because they want to reduce pain, and some clients will just say, no, I just want to get a good workout, and you might have to fight him a little bit to work on some posture. But moving over to slide 50, this is the anterior view of the overhead squat. As you can see, on the left-hand side of the picture, you're going to have 2 red lines that show a good overhead squat in the sense that the knees stay directly over the toes and the feet stay straight. On the right-hand side, you're going to see what happens if their calves might be tight, if the foot might turn out, and that's external rotation of the foot, and that's what we call the, you know, feet turn out is the movement impairment, or the knees might cave inward and touch, which is called the knee moves inward. And specifically, I'm asking you on this slide, what's going to be weak if the knees move inward? And that answer to that question is the VMO. And the VMO, once again, stands for vastus medialis oblique, and that's going to be your middle quadricep. Or if you look at your just to the left of your kneecap, that kind of like a teardrop-looking muscle is going to be the VMO, or vastus medialis oblique. So clicking over to slide 51, more about the overhead squat assessment. You have the 2 different, or this is going to be the lateral view, and a good lateral view is going to be the picture on the left. So notice the 2 lines are perfectly parallel. If someone has maybe tight calves, they're going to end up leaning a little bit forward, and the 2 lines that are shown are going to intersect, or what might be called an excessive forward lean. That's the top one. And specifically with the excessive forward lean, what's going to be weak? That's going to be an important question. And I wrote AT there, trying to figure out what I wrote that for, but what's weak for the excessive forward lean is going to be the either gluteus maximus or the anterior tibialis. And specifically, the anterior tibialis is what they're going to be asking for, and that's what I meant by AT right there. So low back arches is also going to be another impairment, and that's going to be the one on the very right-hand side of the picture. And that is the an excessive arch in the low back in which they kind of are sticking their butt out and arching their back, which the hip flexors get tight, and maybe even a little bit of the abdominals might be a little bit tight. And shoulder complex is going to be tight when the arms fall forward, and specifically what muscle? The latissimus dorsi is tight when the arms fall forward. So that's another test question that they like to ask. So once again, I told you there's going to be about 20 questions from this chapter. We're still moving along, finding more and more and more. So once again, to go over this slide, what is weak from an excessive forward lean? The anterior tibialis, and that's because it doesn't allow you to dorsiflex enough to stay upright. And we can explain that a little bit further into the program here, but also at the shoulder complex, when the arms fall forward, what is going to be tight? And that's going to be your latissimus dorsi. So clicking over to slide 52, you have the single leg squat assessment as well, and that's going to be the in which you squat down on one leg. And it's going to be designed to assess ankle proprioception, core strength, and hip stability. Excuse me. So the position, the client should have should stand and place their hands on their waist and focus on an object straight ahead. The feet should be pointed straight, and the foot, ankle, and knee should be all in line and in neutral position. The main thing you're looking for with the overhead squat assessment is for the knee to cave in. But just like the overhead squat, you're going to want them to do about 5 single leg squats, and you're mainly just going to look from the anterior view. So moving over to slide 54, you're going to notice that her knee on the right-hand picture is going to be caving in. That's the main thing that you're looking for, but typically you can also see that in the overhead squat when the knees cave in when they move down as well. So what's going to be tight when the knees cave in? you're mainly looking at the adductors or the inner thigh muscles. What's going to be weak? The gluteus medius, which is going to be an abductor of the hip. So moving over to slide 55, and once again, all of these can be found in your book. And when we go over the audiobook lecture, I'm going to point these out very specifically as where and what you need to study as far as looking at the movement observations. But let's move on to slide 55, and we're now going to get into the pushing and pulling assessments. So the pushing assessment, you're going to want to push or grab cables like shown in the picture and stand upright and basically do about 20 repetitions or so, or about 15 to 20, and you're going to look at their shoulder movements during this movement pattern. And specifically what you're looking for when you click over to slide 56 is you're looking for their low back to arch, which is the top picture, their shoulders to elevate, which is the middle picture, and the head to go forward, which is the bottom picture. And based off of these movement patterns, the same muscles are going to be tight as were in the overhead squat assessment. But specifically, you can look at your book and refer to the muscles that are tight. So moving over to slide 57, the pulling assessment is the exact same thing as the pushing assessment. So you're gonna, except you're just pulling as opposed to pushing. So as shown here in the picture, she is rowing, doing a standing cable row, and she's gonna do about 20 repetitions with the feet straight ahead, and a head looking forward. And in the pulling assessment, you're looking for the same three things: is the low back arching when they pull and start to fatigue? Is their shoulders elevating when they pull? Or is their head forward? And specifically, when the head protrudes forward, what is going to be weak? The deep cervical flexors. The deep cervical flexors are going to be weak when the head protrudes forward. And I mentioned that in an earlier slide, but that's going to be really important to understand as that might come up on the test. So head protrudes forward during the pulling assessment. And what is weak? The deep cervical flexors. So moving over to slide 59, we also have performance tests. And performance tests are good to know because when you get clients that are relatively in good shape and they're just looking to maybe improve a few things here, you can do some more fun tests like the Davies test, Shark Skill test, maybe a bench press max strength test, as well as a leg press max strength test or squat, to really determine, you know, where they could potentially improve as far as performance measures go. So performance assessments can be used for clients trying to improve basic athletic performance or just athletic performance. And those are the four movement assessments in which we're going to go over: Davies test, Shark Skill test, bench press test, and leg press test or squat. So looking at the performance assessments on page 60, we have the Davies test. The Davies test is designed to assess upper extremity agility and stabilization, and may not be good for people with any shoulder injuries or who lack shoulder stabilization. And when we click over to slide 61, the Davies test is going to basically be a plank position on your hands, or basically push-up position, in which you're going to tap your right hand with your left hand and then place your left hand back on the ground and tap your right hand or your left hand with your right hand, if that makes sense. As you can kind of see in the picture, you're moving back and forth and you're trying to get as many taps with your feet together as possible in 15 total seconds. And what this really assesses is going to be like core strength. You're going to look at postural balances in the core. Can they hold their core tight? Are their shoulders able to stabilize their body? And I typically use this with clients that are in better shape, or maybe some clients that have upper extremity positions in sports, like a quarterback or a baseball pitcher, anyone that needs to throw something, or even swinging can be a good measure for performance. So clicking over to slide 62, we have the Shark Skill Test, and it's important to know what the Shark Skill Test is trying to assess. And specifically, it's designed to assess lower extremity agility and neuromuscular control. And I start that because it is something that might come up on the test. And that's, once again, the Shark Skill Test is designed to assess lower extremity agility and neuromuscular control. So your coordination of your lower body, as well as how agile it is. And this should be viewed as a progression from a single leg squat, and pretty much it's not really that suitable for anyone unless they can do a decent single leg squat, or even they are have relatively good performance or they have performed well on all other tests, then you can do something harder like this. And the shark skill test, if you move over to slide 63, you're going to have the person position a client in a center box of the grid and with their hands on their hips and on one leg. You're going to have the client hop to each box and in a designated pattern and always return to the center of the box. And you want to be consistent with the pattern that you expect of the client so they can get better at it. But you want to perform maybe one practice run through and then do it with each foot. If one foot lags, you can kind of notice. And penalize them a tenth of a second for each of the following faults. Non-hopping leg touches the ground like they lose balance. Hands come off the hips. Their foot goes in the wrong square, so that's a bad coordination. And their foot does not return to a center square. This one gets a little bit complicated, so I typically don't do this too often with my clients. But it can be good for use in someone maybe like an ice skater that needs to be very specific with their lower extremity movement. So moving over to slide 64, next we have the bench press strength assessment. So this is maybe your one of your clients that, you know, they're like, oh, I really want to gain a lot of muscle. I want to gain strength and be able to push a lot of weight, maybe for a sport or just in general to get jacked and tan for the ladies. But the bench press strength assessment is designed to estimate the one rep max of someone's bench press. And it's an advanced assessment and may not be suitable for all clients. And to tell the truth, I've only done this maybe once or twice, as you don't really want to go to a maximal effort on, you know, in the beginning of working with any client, because who knows if they can actually stabilize well enough in order to push that much weight. But you know, for the right client that's extremely in shape, or maybe they're very strong and they want to see where they're at as far as their one rep max, you can do this assessment. So moving over to slide 65, the position you want to be in, yeah, have the client on the bench lying on their back. Feet should be pointed straight ahead and on the ground, and the low back should be in a neutral position, and there's no major arch like a powerlifting arch or anything. Just keep it nice and neutral. And the movement is to have them do about 8 to 10 repetitions with a short rest period, just about 1 minute to warm up. And then you want to add 10 to 20 pounds and perform 3 to 5 repetitions and then rest 2 minutes. And you want to repeat this until they have determined their one rep max. So as soon as they get one rep and can't get a second one, that is going to be their one rep max. So moving over to slide 66, the squat is, you can do this the exact same way as well. I really don't do this with almost anyone, as excessively loading someone's spine is not the safest idea for anyone that you know, is brand new to fitness. Very, very, very pretty dangerous to even go one rep max with someone that has a decent amount of core strength. As being a personal trainer, you want to make sure that you're always thinking of your client's safety first. So once again, it's an advanced assessment for strength specific goals and not suitable for all clients. And if we move over to slide 67, we have the position. You want to stand with the bar on your back. Feet should be pointed straight ahead and about shoulder width apart. And the low back should be in a neutral position. Same thing as the bench press test. Perform 3 to 5 repetitions with perfect form. And then chart the amount of weight used to accomplish the repetitions. And then you could maybe refer to the appendix of the textbook for comparisons on and charts to estimate their one rep max, which will show you like, oh, if you did 5 reps at 200 pounds, then your predicted one rep max would be about 240 or something. So you can look up the appendix and the chart in the back for that too, and do the assessment on yourself. So to finish up on slide 68, it's extremely important to nail these assessments and get good at them, because this is your first impression on your client or for your clients as far as, you know, who is this trainer trying to get my business? Are they actually smart? Do they know what they're talking about? If you can nail these assessments, it looks really good and opens yourself up to potentially get more clientele. And if you track your clients' assessments and track their progress, it really looks good, because it'll keep clients moving or in the future as well. When you show someone that, hey, you lost 8% body fat in the last 3 months, and you're also down 20 pounds, and you also have increased your VO2 by doing the Rockport walk test by, you know, 10 points or something, that's really proving to your client that what you do is a science and it's worth what they're paying for it. And make sure that you guys really take the time, look over this chapter in the book, maybe go through these slides again. And as this is really going to be pretty much, in my opinion, the most important chapter out of the entire textbook. And NASM clearly states that when they put over 20 questions or about 20 questions or so on this chapter on the test, NASM CPT test. So go ahead and move down to the audiobook lecture, which we'll go over another decent lecture over chapter 6 on page 106. And I look forward to seeing you guys there and in the next few chapters.